Kitty Hart Moxon, Reel 3.
Kitty, could you explain to us the differentiation between the SS hierarchy and the hierarchy amongst the prisoners?
Well, what happened in Birkenau, where I was for nearly 2 years, is you had a kind of structure or a hierarchy. You had a prisoner hierarchy and the SS hierarchy. Now, the camp itself was run virtually by prisoners, and it was as follows. We had a what was known as a Lagerkapo. A Lagerälteste, beg your pardon, Lagerälteste, and she was a German prisoner, not a Jewish prisoner, a German political prisoner. Her name was Orly at the time when I was there. And under her was Lagerkapo, I think, a Lagerkapo. There was a Lagerälteste, then there was a Lagerkapo, and then there was a Unterkapo, the one underneath her. Then you had all different capos, which were all prisoners of different nationalities. Could have been Jewish, could have been a Russian, could have been Polish, could have been Hungarian. Whoever managed to get a capo, of course, there were people who wanted to be capos, but there were people who would never wanted to be capos, and possibly I could have at some stage become a capo, but I would have never entertained being a capo. My mother always maintained that there's one thing we shall never do. We shall never, ever carry out the work of the Nazis. On the contrary, we would do everything to resist. So this is one thing I would have never done. Then you had other hierarchies within the blocks. You had a block älteste, that was a block leader, and she could have been any nationality. At one time we had a Hungarian a woman who was in charge. They were usually great big women if they could find them. Then you had a block Schreiberin. Of course there were people working in offices, so they were what are called Schreibers, Schreiberinnen. They also had them in the men's camp. Those were sort of clerical workers. Then you had Stubenälteste. Now those were again the hierarchy underneath the block leaders, who had their helpers to help them with order within the actual blocks. They were responsible for dishing out the rations and handing out the soup. So you had, that was also a hierarchy. In contrast to that, you had the Nazi hierarchy, the SS hierarchy. Now that was extremely complex. You had the camp. First of all, you had a Lager commandant, the overall commandant, who was, as we know, Rudolf Hess at the time. Then there were commandants in charge of every single camp. And we must remember that Auschwitz was divided into some 40 camps. So you may have had some 40 commandants, and they changed hands, changed jobs constantly. So that varied. Birkenau had perhaps, I remember, three or four commandants. We had one called Kramer, we had one called Hessler, and then of course there were the camp doctors, who were also part of the hierarchy, because it was the doctors who determined who shall live and who shall die. So the doctors were a very important part of the hierarchy. And then of course there were like non-commissioned officers, Unterscharführers, Oberscharführers. The Unterscharführers were, I think, non-commissioned officers. They would come into the camp perhaps on bicycles. They would they would be in charge of making sure that all the numbers tallied within the blocks, and they would come and recount the prisoners in front of the blocks. They were called Rapportführers. And then, of course, you had the women hierarchy. You had in the women's camp, we also had women commandants. We had a commandant called Hase, I remember, and numerous SS women of different ranks, who had different functions. Some were in charge of goods, some were in charge of prisoners, some were in charge. And of course, then there were the guards, just straight guards, who were surrounding the camp in their watchtowers with their guns, and they were also used as guards, accompanying work parties. There was always one in front and one at the rear, and the couples would accompany their work parties also at the sides. So there was enormous hierarchy, and I believe it would have taken 12 months to really understand this complex hierarchy. And of course, then you had a separate hierarchy in charge of the crematoria and in charge of the camp that I was in for 12 months, known as a Canada commando. But that is, again, another hierarchy.
You did talk about the SS commandant of all the women's camps called Mandel.
Yes.
Maybe you could describe her and her subordinates, how they behaved.
Most of the time when you saw anyone of the SS hierarchy coming into the camp, the first that you knew it didn't bode well, that something was going to happen, because they didn't come into the camp if there was no reason for it. They left the running of the camp to their own prisoner hierarchy that they had chosen. So if you saw anyone in a green uniform, you immediately realized something was going to happen, and immediately your first thought was, what action am I going to take? What shall I do? Where shall I be? I must not be seen here, I must not be seen there, I've got to hide, I've got to be working somewhere else, or perhaps they're only doing a selection in such and such a block, or maybe here. The worst was, of course, when the commandants came in, like the women commandants, like Mandel, or there was another one called Hase. When they came in, that definitely spelled disaster for the prisoners. It usually meant a selection to the crematoria. I can only remember the face of one SS woman very well, because it was one that one chased me one night. And eventually, and also one SS man called Taube, the Rapportwehr Taube, because I had a punishment of 25 strokes. So these are the two faces that are actually just very much in my mind.
What were you punished for? Why did you get 25 strokes?
Well, like I have explained before, there were certain rules that you had to obey. And if you didn't obey them, well, you did actually ask for punishment. And one rule was, there was a curfew at night, and you were not allowed to leave your block once you were locked in. After the roll call, evening roll call, everybody was locked in the blocks, and there was no way that you could leave the block. And one night, I got out of the block, knowing full well, if I was caught, I would be punished severely. I was determined to I actually located a pile of wood behind one of the barracks, and because it was so terribly cold in our block, I decided I must try to get some of this wood and make a fire so that we could heat up the long heating channel which ran from one end to the other end of the block, and perhaps some of us who managed to salvage or dig up some potatoes, we might be able to cook a bit of soup. And so I did get out that night, and I managed to smuggle myself out, because my mother happened to be on the gate, on the door, and she was that particular night. Everybody had to take turns to take watch so that no one gets out. Well, my mother was on watch that night, and she let me out, and I located a pile of wood, and as I tried to run back, the searchlight picked me out, and an SS woman gave chase, and she realized which block I'd entered, because I immediately submerged myself and got lost among the crowds. But she said if the person who was out wasn't going to own up, the whole block is going to get punished. And so, of course, I owned up the next morning. The next morning I owned up. She came back the next morning, and she took my number, and I thought, well, you know, the punishment normally is you're sent to what was known as Block 25, which was the death block. That's where people were taken to when they were sentenced to death and selected to die. But instead, she took my number, and I was sent to what was known as the penal company. and that was a fenced off area, the other end of the camp, and people were either taken to work in water, submerged in water, or they were beaten. And I was sentenced to actually 25 strokes. So this is why I know this woman who actually caught me, and the man who, the Rapportführer Taube, who actually gave me the 25 strokes. Although I don't remember all the 25 strokes, I only remember a few.
Did you ever come into contact with Mengele?
Yes, I saw the work of Mengele on many, many occasions, because I worked in, my mother worked in the hospital. She was extremely lucky because she was taken to work soon after our arrival in the hospital compound. And although it wasn't a hospital in the sense of what we understand, nonetheless it meant being undercover, not being subjected to twice daily roll calls. And eventually, after I had typhus, I was allowed to stay in the hospital, and I too worked in the hospital on what was known as a dysentery block. My main occupation was actually carrying out bodies and perhaps giving people water during the night. I was actually on night shift. Well, I came into contact with Mengele many, many times. Probably the first time was when I went through a process of selection soon after I recovered from typhus. And I had to run naked in front of Mengele, who hesitated, and he actually turned me around a couple of times and then pointed to the site where I was allowed to live. And of course, daily he came into the dysentery block to carry out selections. He would always wear immaculate white gloves, and he would never touch anyone. He would just point his finger and ask the prison doctor, who always accompanied him, to cross the bunks. Those were the people that he intended to kill. So yes, I saw Mengele almost daily while I was working on Block 12 in a hospital.
And did you know that people were being experimented on?
Well, the experimental block wasn't actually housed in Birkenau. It was in Auschwitz I, and we had no contact with Auschwitz I. But of course, we did know about the experiments that were carried out. There were quite a lot of people that were experimented on, and if they survived the experiments, they were thrown back to Birkenau, and of course, they came and told us about the experiments that were being carried out. So I didn't actually witness any experiments, other than I was caught once, which I thought would be for experiments, but in the event, they only wanted my blood because they were short of blood for soldiers fighting on the Russian front. So they were taking blood of prisoners.
It was unusual, as you say, for your mother to be with you in the camp. That relationship must have been absolutely crucial to your survival. How did you and your mother help each other?
Well, the fact that my mother was in Auschwitz was absolutely crucial to my survival, and for her it was crucial that I was there, of course. It was crucial for both of us. First of all, my mother couldn't help me materially or physically, but mentally she was an inspiration, because she had tremendous faith, and she also talked to the patients and begged them to live another day and not give up. And I, of course, had to help her physically. I managed to barter and bring food, and of course she managed also to look after me while I had typhus. It was absolutely crucial that she was there while I had typhus. She managed to cook soup and feed me while I had typhus. And while my mother had typhus, I was unfortunately working already in a Canada commando a couple of kilometers away, but at that point I managed to obtain goods which enabled me to find people to look after her. So it was absolutely crucial for both of us to have been together in Auschwitz. We wouldn't have survived it if just one of us had been alone.
I want to ask you about, especially as a woman, never being able to wash, being filthy and covered in lice. How did you cope with that, and you know, what did that do to you as a person, as a woman?
Well, during my first 12 months in Auschwitz, I could honestly say that I hadn't washed for 12 months. I couldn't get access to water. It was the most incredibly difficult thing to do, because in charge of the water was, again, someone, a particular privileged person. And unless you could give this privileged person something, you couldn't have access to water. So the first 12 months, my skin became a mixture of red and grey. My scalp, I was actually pleased to have my hair shaved, because my whole scalp was covered in a crust of lice, which I couldn't cope with. I mean, my friends would delouse me and I would delouse them, but no way could we clean our skins of lice. In fact, they would be embedded under the skin. So eventually you didn't worry about it. You tried to keep clean. Very often you washed in your tea because you couldn't drink it. Or I know very often we washed in urine, and it was considered a disinfectant. But of course it didn't actually make one clean. After about 12 months we had a delousing session, and at that point we didn't actually clean ourselves up at all, because we were simply put on the showers and there wasn't any water, there certainly wasn't any hot water, and then we were smeared with sort of a green fluid. So it didn't actually clean you up. It possibly disinfected your skin, which burned your skin, but it didn't actually clean you up. I also don't remember changing my clothes very much the first 12 months. Of course, I did manage to barter and get another pair, perhaps, of trousers or another coat or whatever. So whatever you wore, you wore two or three layers, and you simply couldn't afford to throw anything away, because everything was a commodity. And if you did part with it, you had to sell it. You had to sell it. You had to sell perhaps a bit of underwear for a glass of water, not a glass, a mug of water, or a spoon of sugar, which was a very good compromise if you could get it. But everything had a value, except, of course, money. That was totally valueless. You couldn't buy anything for money. You could only buy something for anything that was negotiable, anything that somebody else would need, and everything was needed. There wasn't even a toothbrush was a luxury, so everything was a commodity. I didn't actually worry too much about being dirty. My main concern was find somewhere to sleep and find something to eat, and don't think about tomorrow. You just thought about this very 1 minute you were living and nothing else. Concentrate, your mind had to be concentrated in these two directions and nothing else.
It sounds as though the extremes of weather in Auschwitz were a factor in survival or lack of survival. Can you sort of describe a little bit what it was like in such extreme cold in that Polish winter, in the summer or when there had been heavy rain?
I believe that survival for me was possibly much easier than it was, say, for people that came from Greece, who had never experienced the Polish winter. Of course, I had been subjected to a Polish winter, the first 2 years of the run, while I was on the run, the savage winter of 1940, the other side of Lublin. So the winter of Auschwitz wasn't something that I wasn't accustomed to. But, of course, it was a very, very harsh time, because we never had enough clothes. We certainly didn't have things like socks. We still had wooden clogs. And you were not allowed to wear more than one layer of, officially, you were not allowed to wear more than one layer of clothes. So the thing that kept me warm were layers of cement paper, which I had in between my outer garment and if I had an undergarment, and that was the sort of insulating thing that I had. But you had no gloves. You very often you had nothing on your head. So a lot of women, a lot of girls, simply died of cold, particularly those that were not accustomed to a harsh winter. Well, conversely, the same happened, of course, during the hot summer. Again, I think probably for people from Greece, it was easier to withstand the hot summers. The hot summers were a crucial factor in determining the death toll, because during the summer you certainly needed a drink and you didn't have any fluid, whereas during the winter very often we managed to eat snow. But you couldn't do that in the summer, and you had no access to fluid. So a lot of girls died of dehydration during the summer, and of sunburn, because the sun was excruciatingly hot, and you were exposed to the elements perhaps for 12 hours. So there were and of course there were extremes also during the night. It was extremely cold on the blocks during the night, and you had no cover, and very often you slept in your wet clothes, which were still damp the next morning. So the weather had a profound impact on survival, and of course the average survival in Auschwitz was between 3 weeks and 3 months. Anyone who survived longer than that didn't survive by Auschwitz rules, only survived by disobeying all the rules or some of the rules.
Can you tell us now, Kitty, about how you got your job
on Canada Commando, and what
Canada Commando means, and describe what you were doing.
I worked in the hospital for some months. Well, there were periods where I didn't work at all. Well, there were periods where I found it was better to totally conserve your energy and don't work at all. And that was by hiding behind a night shift and sleeping with a night shift, and then once again hiding with a day shift and sleeping with a day shift in a certain block. Of course, that didn't work very long. However, it did help to conserve my energy. When I worked in the hospital on the dysentery block, there came a day when Mengele decided to empty the whole of the block. Now, many of the patients on my block were actually convalescent, and they were ready to go back to the camp, because some people were thrown back to the camp and had to start from scratch in their fight for a better position. But Mengele decided there were a lot of sick people, and he had to house them, and so the ones that were on the block were going to be liquidated. Well, we didn't know this, but there came a morning where the block was surrounded, and I was at that time, of course, actually on the staff of the block, and we had to surround the patients and help load them onto the lorries. And at that point we realized, we didn't know before, at that point we realized that all these, because whenever lorries came into the camp, we knew that there were lorries going to the gas chamber. They weren't going anywhere else. They were not going to another camp. We had to help load our friends. Many of us had a lot of friends there. I had two friends who came from prison with me, who survived the camp over 12 months, and at that point they were put on the lorries and they died. After the block was emptied, several days elapsed, and one of the SS women, I couldn't remember which one, came in and remarked that they were going to form a new commando known as the Canada Commando. And there was going to be a night shift and a day shift, and there were going to be about 400 girls picked. And she said, because our block was now empty and the newcomers haven't been put into the block as yet, we could choose, or we could volunteer, if we wanted to join this commando. And no one knew anything about this commando, except that we did know about a group of girls that worked in Auschwitz I, and they wore red headscarves, and we knew that they worked at sorting clothes, but they would never talk about their work. They would always bring in a lot of varied goods into the camp, smuggle them in, because you were not allowed to bring them in legally, and they were actually allowed to live in the camp, and every day they marched out, we didn't know where, and they wouldn't talk about it. My mother decided that if it was a place where I could eat and perhaps clean myself up and live for a day or two, when it was worth it, I must volunteer. And this is how I came to join this Canada Commando. I was allowed to join it. I didn't know what it was at the time, except I knew I was going to be sorting clothes, but what they were, where it was, we didn't know until we actually got there.
When did you find out what the name meant, how it got its name?
The nickname Canada was, I think, it originated from the SS, who were in charge of that small Canada camp, because it was known as the abundance of everything. There was just everything there, goods, people, death, everything. Of course, the Canada didn't represent death, but it represented a country of wealth. And I think this is why they named this particular commander the Canada Commando, and that was known as a Canada camp, although of course the compound was known as G2B, or something like G2B, I think. We marched out, and we didn't know where we were going, in the direction of the crematoria, which of course I hadn't seen up to then. We did see the glow in the background. Mostly it was the view was shielded by huge poplar trees which divide this particular territory from the main camp. So we didn't quite know where we were being taken, but we were taken in the direction of these poplars, and we passed lots and lots of fences and different camps which we didn't even know existed, because you never had a run of any of the other camp except the part you were in. We were taken to a very small area surrounded by a wood of birch trees. The first thing that struck us were four tall chimneys and some low buildings, and a huge, most enormous pile of jumble. I can only describe it as jumble, which looked as though it was three or four story high. And in fact, that pile of jumble were possessions of every description, open suitcases of photographs, clothes, shoes, everything mixed up, three story high. This is the very first thing that I remember of the approach to Canada Commando. The whole compound was relatively small. There were about 30 barracks. Most of them were locked up, so we didn't know what was inside. But we were 400, and we were taken to another compound within this compound, which was fenced off. There were just two barracks, and this was supposed to have been our living quarters. The barrack I was in was the very first one, and it had and these barracks actually had windows, and there was a window facing directly to one of the low buildings, which I later discovered was Crematorium 4. So I had direct view to Crematorium 4. In front of my barrack, which was the very first one, there were only two, was a lawn, a beautiful lawn. It was beautifully kept, and a road. Across this road was what we termed the sauna, where people were taken to be disinfected, and what I later realized also housed huge vats for clothes disinfection, where in fact clothes were taken to be disinfected before they were shipped to Germany. So this was my very first sight of this Canada small camp. This Canada Commando was formed to sort out all the possessions of people who were brought in from all over Europe. All the possessions that people brought in were left at the ramp, or shall we say at the train, where people disembarked. There was also a men's Canada Commando, that is the equivalent group to the women. Their main occupation was to go to the ramp or to the platform and collect the suitcases on handcarts and bring them back to the Canada and empty them onto this big pile. We, the girls, were subdivided into different groups. First of all, a night shift was formed and a day shift. And I was actually on night shift. The whole of the I was there for 8 months, and I worked 8 months on night shift. So I was allocated into a barrack, and my prime occupation at one stage was to sort men's jackets. In fact, I had to go to this big pile, or very often we had a group of girls who would bring in, or even sometimes men would come in and bring in piles of clothes and empty them at the end of the barrack. And here again, that built up to a huge pile as high as the ceiling. And it was sort of my job, and the same with the group that I was working with. We all had to sort different clothes. Well, I had to sort, at one point, I had to sort nothing but men's jackets. So I had to go to this pile and look for nothing but men's jackets. I had to place these jackets on trestles, on a sort of a table, and I had to feel all the seams for any hidden objects. Very often we had to open the seams, and if we felt any objects, we had to take them out. And very, very often, by the end of the day, or end of the night, I should say, end of the night shift, we had a 12-hour shift, by the way, we would collect a bucket full of jewellery, or banknotes, or whatever was hidden in the jackets, not just in the pockets, but in the seams. I remember at one